This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. The number of people seeking and receiving emergency shelter due to domestic violence across the state of Missouri appears to be increasing, according to the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And in Illinois, a steady increase of adults and children have been requesting and receiving shelter due to domestic violence for the past 3 years. That's what's been reported by the state's Coalition Against Domestic Violence. The increasing rate of domestic violence reported across this region affects many families, parents, and kids. And that's our focus today, the children of domestic abuse survivors. The kids of domestic abuse survivors, whether or not they experienced abuse directly, are deeply affected as well. You may remember our interview earlier this year with Monique Green, a domestic violence survivor who now serves as the board president for St. Louis Survivors Legal Support. As often happens after our show, our conversation spilled out into the hallway where Monique shared with me the impact of her former partner's abuse on the entire family. She joins me now to talk about it. Monique, thank you for coming back to St. Louis on the Air, and thank you also for inspiring the topic of today's discussion.
Thank you for having me back, Elaine.
So let's start with what you had shared in that hallway. You were 30 years old when the abuse started, but you didn't recognize it as abuse until about 3 years later. How old were your children, Monique, at the time that you were coming to realize what was happening to you was, in fact, abuse?
I think my oldest was about 8, and my youngest would have been about 2 years old.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first time you talked about it candidly with them?
I did not speak with them until I was ready to apply for a divorce.
Mm-hmm. So how many years were we talking here?
We're probably talking about 10 years.
10 years. Were there any signs or signals that they were seeing what you knew was happening?
Yes, they were. There were many signs and signals when my ex-husband would leave the home. There was a lot of happiness, and we were able to do many things. But when the children recognized it was time for him to come home from work, it was, let's scurry and put everything in place, because anything that we might do could tip his anger.
Mm-hmm. We also have with us someone who counsels domestic violence survivors and their children, and that's Asia Bui, who is Director of Residential Services at the Women's Safe House. Asia, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you work with both parents and children who have been subject to abuse. How much of Monique, what she just shared, even briefly, how much of that have you observed in those who sought help at the Women's Safe House?
We don't like to compare stories because each family has an individual story, even though they have a lot of similarities, but that's their story.
Mm-hmm.
But I will agree that that's typically what transpires in the home.
Mm-hmm. So there's definitely then a marked difference in the atmosphere of the home when the abuser is not present.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Monique, you know, you spent years in that relationship, in your marriage, not fully recognizing that it was abuse that you were experiencing. What are some of the red flags, Asia, that are commonly overlooked?
It is the simple things that we don't pay attention to. I would think that in today's age, most of the time, it's the digital control.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of the times what an abuser would do, and it goes into the financial, even if you're a working person and they have control over the checking account, they are the only people that have access to the checking account. Simple things as checking your email for you and not allowing you to have access to your email. Sending threatening text messages, and threats don't always come off as anger, like, it's simple things like, mm-hmm. you should have the food cooked by 5 o'clock. Things of that nature. Invading your personal space, like having access to your cell phone and going in your cell phone and looking at messages, that communications that you're having with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I think that people think those things are a sense of romance, like he really just doesn't want, or she doesn't want me to worry about any of these things. And they're so romantic and they love me, and not understanding that that's a red flag, mm-hmm. as well, for yourself and for them to feel that they need that type of control.
So. Right. Monique, you're nodding as as Asia is describing some of those flags. What is it that you recognize? What is it that happened with and around you?
I actually experienced everything that Asia described. And while this was many years ago, we were on the cusp of how social media is being used today. I can say that I was on the forefront of misappropriation of social media by having accounts set up in my name that I didn't set up, falsifying information, taking keys to the post office box, trying to restrict access to accounts. So everything Asia described is also what I experienced. But when you're going through, because when you're with a partner or you're married to someone, and if you have children with them, you don't go into the marriage thinking, I better have an escape plan because he's a potential or she's a potential abuser.
Mm-hmm. So Monique, was there ever any point, since we are talking about children are dependent on the adults in their home, on their parents, to guarantee a certain level of stability for them. Was there ever any point at which you were staying with your ex-partner because you wanted your children to have a certain measure of stability, especially given the power that your ex-husband was exercising over your access to the things that you needed for daily life?
First of all, I'll say when you marry someone and you have children, at least in my case, you hope that that marriage will last and you hope to keep that family unit together. So that was the driving force for me, because statistics, particularly where African Americans are concerned, many homes are fatherless. So my perspective was to provide that home life that would provide stability, mm-hmm. for my children.
Yeah.
It's most definitely, and we were speaking about this a little earlier, people always think that, most people think it's black and white, just leave. And they don't understand with domestic violence, it's a lot of gray,
mm-hmm.
a lot of gray area. Because that person is actually, especially if you married that person and that person is a part of your family, you stood in front of God and said, this is the person that I'll be with for the rest of my life in sickness and health as long as we both shall live.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do try to make it work.
Yeah.
And you hold a lot. You know, it's the shame of it. It's the support of wanting to be there for that person because you recognize that they're not well. It's wanting to support the kids and trying to be the best parent that I can be, and cannot do this by myself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot that goes with it. It's not black and white at all.
Yeah. Asia, for those who suspect that their loved one is in a situation of domestic abuse, how is it that they can approach that topic with them? I mean, should they, shouldn't they, are there certain physical settings in which it's more beneficial?
I think that I'm also a survivor of domestic violence, and mine started early. And I had a friend, and every day, it was the Eve song, Love is Blind. I'm showing my age a little bit here, but it was the song, and what she described in the song was about her friend being in an abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend, every day for probably 2 months, she would just call and lay the phone down and play the song. Because I didn't recognize it at first,
mm-hmm.
but she did.
Yeah.
And I think just making space, knowing your loved ones and making space for that person to not feel shamed,
mm-hmm.
To understand that they are supported and regardless of the decision that they make, because truthfully, it takes a woman statistically 7 times before they actually leave an abuser. They attempt 7 times to leave before they actually leave.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding like, hey, this is most definitely the right move to make for you, but I do understand that if you're not ready to make it, and when you are ready, I'm ready to, mm-hmm. and I'll be here for you.
Right. Monique, in your case, was there anyone else who was recognizing what was going on and maybe sending you, maybe not Eve songs, but finding some other way to demonstrate that they were seeing what was happening?
Absolutely. In fact, my godmother and even my mother and some other relatives. And I have to say, I wasn't the sharpest knife in the deck at that point, because I wanted so badly to keep my marriage together. I could not hear them when they were making gentle statements such as, you know, you're not better than anyone else, but you were trained in this particular way and they were trained that way, and maybe it's just not a fit. So they had to say that over and over and over until I actually had that hard experience. And then they just received me. I think it was more of, finally, our prayers have been answered. She's received what we've been saying, so we'll welcome her into the family.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanna add this regarding the family. There's certainly a way that family can speak to the survivor or the person in the abuse. And the victim or survivor needs to understand that there are going to be family members that are in a position to take on the unexpected burden of housing and finance, which I had.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also going to be family members who are going to want to distance themselves. So the survivor needs to understand that every family member has that right.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so true. Most survivors, because of the shame that they carry around with the abuse that they went to, most of the time they don't really share with family. It's always an outside person. I can use me for an example. I have loving parents. They were married. My dad was principal of a school. My mom also has a wonderful job in dentistry. I'm the only child. You know, I had a wonderful support system. However, it was the shame, the burden of shame that came with it. And how would they react? You know, if I told them this, would this hurt them? And you start protecting the people that you love, and that's the way that you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I need to protect them because I don't want them to think that they failed in any type of way.
Right, even as you are.
Yeah.
Hurting,
mm-hmm.
and being hurt. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse, you can reach the National Domestic Violence Hotline 24/7 by calling 800-799-7233. That's 800-799-7233, or text BEGIN, BEGIN, to 88788. We're going to take a very quick break here, but we'll return to this conversation shortly. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation with Monique Green and Asia Bui. We're discussing domestic abuse and its impact on survivors, specifically parents and children. Now, Monique, before the break and toward the beginning of this segment, you had been talking about how your kids would scurry when they knew their dad was coming home, that the mood in the home would change. How else would you describe what they experienced or what they were showing at the time?
I think they were fearful. They wanted to stay in an intact home as much as their brains could process it. When you're talking about young children processing abuse, I'm just going to say they can't. Their whole world revolves around school, friends, and play. So for them to watch a situation where someone is getting potentially harmed physically, or they're hearing emotional violence, I do not believe children's brain can actually process that type of abuse. The result is they develop a set of behaviors where they may develop coping mechanisms. They may become more reclusive. They may gravitate towards certain kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. Aja, what Monique has shared, have you seen that in the children you've seen come through the women's shelter?
Yes. So at the Women's Safe House, we are family-oriented. So we don't just service the women, the ladies. We also service the children as well. Mm-hmm. And we actually have more children as residents than we do women. And what we understand is that children are secondary survivors. And sometimes because they have experienced the physicalness and the emotional things that come along with abuse firsthand, they become primary survivors as well with the mom. And their understanding is not always as one would like for it to be simple. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of gray.
Yeah.
They love the person that they were living with. They love them. You know, they love the person that is, whether it's a parent or a spouse or whatever the situation is, they love that person. And to come into shelter, and regardless, it's beautiful. We did a renovation and the rooms are gorgeous, and it's not home. At the end of the day, it's a shelter. Mm-hmm. We make it as home-like as we possibly can. But them too, they are survivors. And so it takes therapy, a lot of therapy. And we have a adolescent therapist who works with the children. And we also have a youth development department. And so the kids have their own case manager, and they do a lot of play therapy to try to tackle some of those things that they encounter when they were in the home and help them to process where they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But they most definitely start to behave differently. Either they do seek out, when in their teen years, they seek out people that resemble the person that they were misplaced from, or they do the opposite and go the opposite way.
Right.
Just to kind of justify what happened to them.
Mm-hmm. And as you've mentioned, you know, teen years, clearly being a survivor means that you process over time. Monique, with your kids, with your daughter and your son, are there things that showed up for them sort of later in life related to, you know, what they had, not only what they had witnessed, but what they had experienced? Like your son now is in his 30s and your daughter's in her 20s.
Absolutely, Elaine. In fact, they look at their relationships with people through the lens of what they had witnessed before. So, for example, I think there was a great hesitancy on the part of my son to get married because he did not have that model of marriage, and he was looking for utopia before making that decision.
Mm.
Oh, well, I need mom. I need to just see if it works in this area or if it works in that area. Does it work in the finances? Do the families mesh? So I think that it still plays a part, because many times adult children don't realize until later that they suffer emotional abuse, as Asia said, that they are secondary survivors of domestic violence. And particularly with a female, a young woman as a survivor, I think it creates a degree of skepticism in terms of any relationship. So I think the pendulum might swing very far to the left or the right until they begin to address some of their issues and connect it to their experiences in the past.
Mm-hmm. Something that I did want to kind of put a finger on very, at least briefly, Asia, when you talked about abuser, you said he or she. And so the extent to which abusers, I mean, I think in the popular imagination, the abuser is always a male figure. In my own family, extended family, I have a relative who was abused by his wife. So, I mean, how much of that is also important to acknowledge?
I think that it's crucial for us to acknowledge that men also get abused. They get abused. They get abused in all the same ways that women will get abused mm-hmm. with certain partners. And sometimes it even ends up fatal, as it does with women.
Mm-hmm.
I think across the country, we're at like 1 in 10 men are being physically abused by their partners.
Mm-hmm. Asia, to what extent, you know, is domestic abuse, you know, cyclical or generational?
I think it's to the extent of most of the time it is a learned behavior for the most part. Most people that you see that are abusers, they've learned those behaviors from different people in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And not being able to recognize the signs that they are performing in that way early on and it's not being addressed. You know, it's kind of like what I said at the beginning with the give me your password to your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get the password to your phone.
Yeah.
You know, and then when they get in your phone, then they want to see who you're in communication with. And to the person that's actually doing it, I just want to be this close to them. And, you know, this is me loving them. And it's like no one is pointing out that that's inappropriate behavior.
Mm-hmm. So there's some rationalization.
Yeah, it's a lot of rationalization. I love them so much. You know, it's today's age, the toxic thing. I'm so toxic. I do this because I love them so much. And it's like, you know, and vice versa.
Right.
You know, and it's like, no, that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you're correct with the term because it is toxic, but it's not okay. It's not healthy at all.
Right, right.
So,
Monique, how is it that your kids have approached their relationship with their father? Do they have one with him?
I will say one does and one does not.
Mm-hmm.
But Elaine, if I could just step back and say something that Asia mentioned. And I don't recall the exact statistics. Maybe you do, Asia. But when we look at those that are incarcerated, there is a correlation with some of those that are incarcerated if they grew up in an abusive situation.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a greater chance if you are a male repeating that behavior and ending up in prison than if you are a female.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is something that we need to address at the very beginning.
Right.
Early childhood to prevent the incorrect trajectory for that mm-hmm. that child.
And I think that gets at some of the systemic reasons there is cycles and generations of abuse. Monique, for your son and daughter in the healing process, what has been helpful for them?
Counseling and group counseling, including myself, giving them an opportunity to ask every possible question. And they're very bright adults, and to weigh that information themselves. One of the things that my mother instructed me to do was never speak ill about my children's father, that they would eventually come to their own conclusion. So that is something I practiced. And as they continue to grow and mature, they have come to their own conclusion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there anything that you wish you would known early on, Monique, in terms of getting help for your kids or like advice that you have for parents in similar situations?
My advice is believe that people are who they present themselves as. There's an opportunity for all of us to change, but as individuals, we're not called to change those people. So believe who they present themselves as and step back and protect your core and your children and allow that other party to get the help they need.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree.
Mm-hmm.
I think that prevention is the key. and to acknowledge what's going on and really arm yourself with information on what domestic violence, all the different forms of domestic violence, mm-hmm. And not just concentrate so much on the physical aspect of it. That's a big thing, too.
Yeah. Tell us what those, you know, how it can show up.
Well, you have the emotional. I think I said this before, that a lot of the times people are waiting for curse words, and he called me this, and he or she called me this, and she did that. But it sometimes appears as more settling than that.
Right.
The ability to be able to control who you're around. And it doesn't always look like if you go over there, I'm going to hurt you. Sometimes it looks like I don't feel good. You had plans to go out with a group of people, and then all of a sudden they're like, I don't feel good. And, you know, I really need you and depend on you because I'm sick and I need you to stay here. And those things are telltale signs that you're heading down the wrong road with that person.
Mm-hmm. And I want to add to that, Asia, and say from an emotional standpoint, if a person is constantly saying to you, oh, well, you didn't grow up the way I grew up, and you didn't have your father for the period of time, you don't know how to behave. Sometimes it's subtle, and sometimes it's not so subtle that mm-hmm. they're just working on your self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And that is a form of emotional abuse.
Mm-hmm. Which leads into psychological abuse. Because when you take a person away from what's familiar and what's supportive of them, like their friends and their family, because you're intruding on those relationships now, or even pointing out things. Did you hear how she talked to you? Your sister talked to you? Did you hear how your friend did X, Y, Z, you know, or whatever the situation is? And that's a form of controlling, and kind of, and that's really psychological because it has you questioning everything about yourself and other relationships.
Mm-hmm. And in some relationships, the abuser will go to your family members and suggest to your family that you're doing something wrong, which puts you in a position where you're ashamed and embarrassed to go to your family.
Yes, most definitely. And so it's a lot of different things. You have the emotional and the psychological plus the physical. You also have financial, of course. You will have people that say, like, quit that job. Quit your job. You don't really like it. You don't need it anyway. But because they understand that if you're not employed, you won't be able to be self-sufficient and you would depend on them financially. Or person that just says, you know, let me pay all of the bills and all of the money. I'll be responsible for all of it.
Yeah.
Or that person that will go and get loans in your name without you knowing. And then you look up when it's time for you to leave that person and you try to get a place of your own and you can't because your credit is terrible now because they misuse your credit.
Yeah.
It's also a financial situation where an individual might cap your salary and say, you can't make more than this, so don't look at this particular job.
That so. Too. Yeah, so yeah. It looks really different. And so witnessing those and understanding those signs and educating yourself. And I really wish with children that we had more activities on prevention in schools where they can understand those signs early on.
Yeah. Are there enough resources to handle an increased caseload, particularly working with children?
There's never enough resources. And I think that all of us are trying our best. We're trying to do the best that we can, especially at the Woman Safe House. Like, we're doing everything we possibly can in our outreach program. Also, in our aftercare program, we're doing the best that we possibly can, not only to service the ladies, but also to service the children in the community in general. We recently have even a pet safe house where families that are leaving an abusive situation can now bring their animals in.
Right.
They don't have to leave their animals behind because sometimes that's a big deal too. A person will rationalize staying. You know,
right,
like I
right.
can't because I can't leave the dog. You
yeah,
know,
we've
the
talked
dog.
About that on the show, actually. Yeah.
So at the Woman Safe House, we do have a pet shelter. So,
And this our final question here, Monique. You know, to a parent, a child is always a child, right? Even when they're grown. Is there something that you are continuing to learn and process that you want other parents who are domestic abuse survivors to know?
get help and learn how to speak with your children to bring them along instead of having to clean up 10 years after it's over. Seek a counselor, seek a social worker so that you can go through it together and answer their questions. I also want to build on what Asia said around the children. The court system has appointed guardian ad litem to represent the children, but oftentimes they are ill-equipped. Mm-hmm. Just because they're attorneys does not mean they understand the social issues that a child is going through. And one of the things my daughter felt is that the guardian ad litem never listened to her. Mm-hmm. So until I was able to pay for an outside counselor, she did not feel her voice was heard. So I would admonish the court to partner a social worker with the guardian ad litem. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Asia Bui is Director of Residential Services at the Women's Safe House, and Monique Green is St. Louis Survivors Legal Support Board President and Pastor at Living the Word Church in Collinsville. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.